Hi, this is Roger Green, host of the Surfing the Mesh Tsunami podcast. This week, we're offering five conversations from episode 9, in which Hannes Hagström joins Jörn Schottenberg, Louise Campbell, and me to discuss recent work on in-office scanning, impact of different diet types, and patient prognoses. Plus, from the vault, a conversation from last year's EASL Congress about patient identification and screening along the clinical care pathway. This conversation focuses on the role of VCTE in terms of prognostic ability of VCTE when compared to biopsy, and separately, value as a therapeutic adjunct. It starts with Hannes Hagström and Jörn Schottenberg discussing a study from Vincent Wong and a large group of co-authors, one of whom is Hannes, that compares the abilities of VCTE and biopsy on predicting outcomes. After Hannes mentions the studies and makes the key point that VCTE might be sufficient to predict the risk of outcomes in clinical trials or other events, Jörn describes the study in greater detail and goes on to ask a basic question. If a patient comes into a referral center with a VCTE-supported score of 10.2 kilopascals, what does that tell the physician about how to treat? Hannes notes a further complication. VCTE is a tricky test to do properly, particularly in obese patients. He asks whether high kilopascal scores on VCTE should be repeated. Jörn responds that in situations like that, he often does the retest himself, goes on to suggest that unlike all other tests, a repeat VCTE test 4 weeks later might serve a therapeutic purpose while also validating the earlier result. Louise Campbell agrees, commenting that frequent retesting can have two different kinds of impact. During holiday season, it can inform the patient on exactly how much change increased eating and drinking has caused the liver. And during more normal times or therapeutic interventions, it can show the patient how quickly improved behavior might translate into improved liver health. It's striking how fast new research around issues of patient treatment and therapeutic options are stacking up, and how the number of questions grows even faster than the number of studies. This conversation covers several points, but it's pretty strictly focused on treating the right patients the right way, at the right point in time, with the right agent. So just sit back, listen, learn, enjoy, and when you're done, join the dialogue in our LinkedIn discussion group. So with that, why don't we dive in? I think I kind of started to dive in already. Last couple, three episodes that we've done have focused largely on the Rezdiffra approval on March 14th. But that's not the only exciting piece of news we've had in muscle land recently in steatotic liver disease. A bunch of publications, some of which some of the folks on this call are authors on it, we'll be talking about. Some drug news, some exciting meetings. And I think a tremendous amount of good energy, and that's looking back, and then positive energy looking forward in terms of publications ahead, meetings ahead, and all that. The other interesting thing that I'm starting to observe in conversations is people are starting to think a little bit more holistically about what treatment might look like in a year or two, as we start to see the shapes that things are taking in terms of some of the clinical trial results, some of the device and diagnostic results, and some other things like that. So I want to start by asking each of us to pick one or two pieces of research that you've been involved with or just you've read about in the last month or two that you think are particularly encouraging and why.
Hannes Hagström.
So I can maybe start. So I was a little bit involved in a paper with Vincent Wong, where in JAMA, and I guess a lot of people were actually co-authors on that paper. It was a very, very nice multi-center study. And I think that sort of work is something we should do more of. So pull our resources together for a sort of a more meaningful analysis. Well, essentially just showing the prognostic ability of FibroScan to predict outcomes. And it was actually in this particular paper shown to be on par or better than biopsy. And that is, of course, very reassuring, also given the information from FDA that biopsy would not be needed in order to start treatment with Rezdiffra. And I guess that they're going to say that on all upcoming drugs. So FibroScan may be enough if you want to predict the risk of outcomes. And we also, just a few days ago, published a very similar study from Sweden with around 14,000 patients looking at prognosis. However, not all of those were muscled, but it was a mix of patients with hep C, alcohol, and so on. But essentially showing the same thing, that the higher levels you have on your FibroScan results, the higher is the risk to develop decompensation. And that can be used to guide people, you know, saying you have a value of 10.2. What does that tell you in terms of prognosis? So I think more and more of those papers are coming out, which is nice in our field when we try to predict outcomes that may lie very sort of long time ahead from many patients.
Superb. Superb. Jörn or Louise, go next.
Jörn Schottenberg.
This is a notable study, and Hannes, congratulations for participating and supporting it with your data set. You didn't take the deep dive into it, but it combines over 16,000 patients with VCTE over a tremendous time span. And just looking at the abstract, median follow-up of 51.7 months, majority of patients repeated VCTE. And from that group, you derived the events, right, which showed both liver-related events, but also also mortality. And I think that's the type of analysis we want, kind of a real-world cohort. It's not derived from a pure study population, something we see at tertiary referral care centers. These patients coming in, as you said, with a 10.2, what does it tell us for the patient? When should we see them again? There's a lot of discussion of how soon should we see those patients again? And I think this is really a landmark paper in setting some of those metrics and informing us on it. Again, I think it's great.
Yeah, it's a very nice cohort, and I think there are a lot of ongoing studies using that particular cohort as well. So probably many more papers are going to sort of come out of it. What we have to consider also is that one of the findings was that you see if you improve your FibroScan levels, then your prognosis looks better as well. But we also have to factor in that, you know, sometimes it's a tricky examination to do. I guess you agree, Louise. I mean, sometimes it's just tricky and you get a false positive result. So what the improvement or perceived improvement actually means is just that maybe the first measurement was wrong. So we actually have it now in our updated Swedish guidelines for MASLD saying, well, if you do a fiber scan and it's high, consider actually repeating it with especially if you do it with a new sort of an unexperienced user, to ensure that you actually do a second fiber scan before you act on the results. I don't know, how do you do it in your setting, Jörn? Do you also only sort of buy the first result, or are you sometimes a bit cautious?
I've gone back and redone them myself. Sometimes you get readings where you say, well, sometimes there's an obvious problem if somebody doesn't observe the IQR, it's been a difficult exam, and then you get an invalid reading, which of course are not reported in these type of studies. But the clinical routine, you get that, you know, it's a 28 and you have an IQR of 75 or something, and then it's all over the place, and we do those. Sometimes I tend, if I have the patient come back, just retest them again when discussing results of labs after 4 weeks or something. It's not a time frame where you'd normally repeat an ultrasound or something, but for a FibroScan, sometimes capturing more data points might be useful to reduce that noise in some cases. I think in many cases, of course, you get a valid first. There are some cases that are improving, and I think, Louise, that'd be interesting to hear on your experience. You always highlight that the information we get the patients changes them, or their lifestyle helps them to change their lifestyle, and then actually you can see better readings.
Louise Campbell.
I think that's right. What I see scanning more of the general population and knowing people better is where you get regular scans, particularly post COVID, you saw people's livers change very drastically when they started socializing again, drinking again, and partying heavily. And you would see their scans change. If you didn't know what their original scans were, you'd go on this one scan, you'd be referring them to a physician, and it's more inflammation. It's a sudden increase in fat, the same way that we can suddenly decrease fat over a very short period of time. And for some people, we will see that react. We talk about it when we talk about Hep B, and you'll get the flares through the enzymes during the year, but we never take those bloods regularly enough to see those flares or to see what's going on. And I think we do have an opportunity with FibroScan to be able to add it to a routine investigation every time you come in, see what's changing.
And now back to Roger.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. If you have any questions or comments about the content of this conversation or the entire episode, please put them in the review section of the page in which you downloaded this conversation, or send an email to questions@surfingmash.com. We're still working on next week's topic, but we've got two ideas and they're both great. Until then, stay safe, surf on. We'll see you on the podcast. Bye-bye now.